Welcome to the Myth That Make Us podcast. And today I have on Michael Phillips. He is the host of the Third Eye Drops podcast, which is one of my favorite podcasts. If you're interested in psychedelics and the type, if you're a fan of Terrence McKenna and you want to see that energetic spirit inhabited by a meat suit that is alive right now, I would for sure go check out his podcast. He's got amazing guests and he's had me on a couple of times. And every time I talk to him, it feels like we're brothers and our meat suits have yet to meet in suits in person. We'll fix that one day and we'll record it. But as always, it's truly a pleasure to have a conversation with him. And we did something a little bit different this time. People who come on the podcast who have already done, who have been on the podcast before, like Michael Garfield, I am not going to re-ask them, you know, the same questions because that wouldn't really make sense. And so when there are repeat guests like this, we're just going to talk about whatever. And I think it's a nice way to break up the episodes that are deep dives into people's personal stories. And so this conversation, we get into the type of stuff that we always get into, which is, you know, the existential foundation of our life and how do we create meaning and can we create meaning and what type of meaning should we create? What type of story should we be telling ourselves? And I think you guys are going to love it. Also, I've been getting people asking me to explain why I ask the questions that I ask. And so what I'm thinking I'll do is I'll just kind of explain one question per intro until we just kind of move through the core questions. And so the first question that I want to kind of dance with you guys is what I think is the most important question that I'm asking on the podcast. And it's essentially, what is your favorite story? And then how would you retell it to a smart 10-year-old? Okay, I think that our intuitional minds are vastly more powerful and intelligent than our conscious thinking mind. And one of the tools that our intuitional mind uses to speak to our conscious mind is what we're interested in. You don't get to pick what you're interested in. You don't get to force what you're interested in. And I think the metaphor here that makes the most sense is the snitch from Harry Potter. There's this thing that catches your eye. And I think it's the God inside of you pointing your attention towards what you need to be paying attention to. And I think the more that we're in tune with our intuition, the more that our feeling of interest is increased. And so you're being shown thousands of stories over the course of your life, but just a couple really fucking stick to you. And I think the sticking is like a magnetic pull from your unconscious, almost like the God inside of you is screaming at you, look at this stupid. So that's why I ask, what is your favorite story? I think that that's a hint towards how you need to be looking at the world, or at least what is an adaptive way to look at the world? And then how would you retell this to a smart 10-year-old? How our brain processes information is we condense it to a gist inside of the architecture of a story. It is how we learned before we had a written language. We told stories to each other. Our ancient ancestors were telling stories. And the stories that they told, the oldest stories, were myths. And the myths were attempting to explain, without them knowing it, how to behave in a way where you don't fucking die. And there's something about imagining that you're telling a story to a smart 10-year-old that forces you to get rid of the bullshit details. And it invites you to get to the gist. And when we pick our favorite story and we have to gist it down to our version, I find it like it's almost like putting a piece of tape over a doorknob and you peel the tape away and then you can see the fingerprint. I think when you have someone tell their favorite story, like they were telling it to their child, you see one of the fingerprints that's impressed on their soul. It's kind of dramatic, but it's also the way that I think about it. Don't at me. So yeah, I'll keep explaining these questions per episode. I thought that that would be a little interesting nugget for everyone listening. And as always, if you love what we're doing here, please go drop a rating and a review on iTunes. That is kind of the main metric that people tend to use to see, like, is this dude even doing something that I should pay attention to? And it's used to get new guests on the podcast. Because I may have shared this before, but I would really like to get, you know, like the top prominent psychologists and philosophers on this podcast to kind of help me understand how humans think and the stories we tell ourselves and how to use that in a way that's more effective. And I think it'd be really great for everyone listening to kind of hear experts share how they see whatever this project is that's unfolding on this podcast. So that's a really concrete way that you guys can help support this. Anyways, thank you, sincerely. I love you, and namaste. So you were saying that you had an experience last night that was unlike anything that you've experienced yet. What were you talking about?
Yeah, you know, you hear this story about this overriding nature message coming through in psychedelics a lot.
Yeah.
And I've certainly had hints of that, but not in such a overt, undoubtable, palpable way as I did last night. And it was just very, you know, when you say some of these things out loud that I was confronted with, it sounds so obvious, but
right,
it put to rest a lot of my philosophical and existential wriggles in just a really, really undeniable way. You know, these questions where, you know, well, maybe, you know, existentialism versus essentialism, for example, like,
right,
do you have a purpose? Or do you have no purpose other than what you decide? You know, that's essentially right. The dialectic between essentialism and existentialism. And man, that whole thing just got fucking smushed by the energy. You know, it's just like that whole idea of what are you talking about? You know, the whole kind of notion of the Camus myth of Sisyphus, where we're stuck in this toil and this existential situation of punishment for no reason, and we just have to roll the boulder up the hill and suffer through it. And there is no reason why. God didn't put you there for a reason. You're just there. You're rolling the boulder. You have no choice except for whatever context you decide to apply to it. And oh my God, did that just get so annihilated. Like,
so
I had this
set the stage for people yesterday night. Yeah. You did what?
I ate mushrooms.
What was the container that you created for yourself when you did it?
Just at my place, you know, dim lighting, a playlist of music that is it's playlists are curating the right playlist is very tricky for these events because you don't want it to direct the mood too much.
Right.
But you don't want it to be so ethereal that it's not even like really guiding you anywhere. It seems like you want just enough to evoke some things in your mind and just enough to, you know, that chord's a little minor and maybe it's going to send you into some dark places for a little bit, but there's some valuable information in those dark places. So typically, you know, that's sort of the container. Comfortable, familiar, with sort of a ambient playlist going.
And
man, I mean, stuff just came in. Stuff just came in very, very loud and clear.
What would you say was the new myth that you emerged with afterwards? Because it sounded like you went in with a vague sense of this Sisyphus myth. And that's not what you're holding on to the day after.
Yeah, well, I mean, that whole existentialist argument from a philosophical standpoint is fucking bulletproof, right? Because there's nothing empirical that you can present to that argument to disprove it. I mean, yeah, we are here. We do feel like we're kind of stranded on this rock and life is what you make of it. And even if it's not, and there is some metaphysical reality, you're never going to prove that empirically. You're never going to, you know, show anybody a mathematical proof or, you know, weigh it down and prove that. So if you want that argument, by all means, take it. No one will ever, you know, logically defeat that position, but it has never satisfied me. And you know that I'm much more open to there being some sort of mystery behind reality. But
yeah,
what I struggled with, I would say, is how to contextualize that fact and how to really bring it together and bring together that dialectic that I was describing to you, where, you know, I think it's overly rosy to say every single person and every single thing that happens is for a reason and it's perfect and, you know, God's plan type thinking. But I also am not nearly dark enough or absurdist enough to go the direction of everything's just random and we're just here for this, you know, no purpose whatsoever except what we make of it. I'm not cool with either one, yeah. but how do you marry those two things? And the way, and you ask what the myth is, and the myth is, I actually wrote this down, it's the cosmic yes. And what the cosmic yes is on the most basic level, what does every organism want? That's the actual question to you. What do you, you know, what does every organism want at the most basic level?
I think a bodily sensation of what we would use language to say as either positive or satiation or filled mint, you know, because most creatures don't have language. But I would say the sense feeling of yes.
I would agree, but even more basic than that, even more basic. What is like the one
to avoid pain?
Yes, even more basic than that, though.
To fuck.
Yes. Just to fucking be alive, right? I mean, right. Look at how hard everything is trying to be alive, man.
Yeah.
Little. You know, there's fossilized organisms that didn't make it on Mars. There is single-celled organisms crawling around in the dirt looking for nutrition. There are animals running around trying to, you know, feed themselves via whatever means necessary.
Yeah.
Life wants to live, man. And life wanting to live is the fucking cosmic yes.
Yes.
And I feel like, you know, there's this vacuum of, you know, we've talked so much about the vacuum of meaning, the vacuum of some greater purpose. And it's just so wild to me that we don't get that. That's it, man. It's the purpose is just helping things live, helping life spread, helping life be healthy, you know, not want on just everybody fuck right now, make as much life as you possibly can. Of course, we have to be responsible gardeners and tenders of that life, but life wants to spread, man. It wants to live. It wants to grow. And it came through to me so clear. And it's so sad that we're actually doing more right now to fucking prevent that. And yeah. We're like, you have whole portions of basically cancerous sentient cells not even wanting to live, not even wanting to aid in the spread of life. And that is beyond sad.
Yeah, an interesting thing that comes up in me is all of the philosophers who have spent the time creating the rational arguments for why to say no to the cosmic yes, or why there isn't a cosmic yes, or how it's futile. If you take a step back and if you just look at what the human ape thing is doing when they're doing that, is they're playing a status game. Because they're in a social group and they're trying to attain prestige. They are choosing yes as they're writing the philosophical argument for why you shouldn't live or why there isn't meaning. And I've grappled with this, you know, for a long time. I before I started doing psychedelics, I was all about, you know, there is no meaning and we're just like, there is nothing going on other than the lies that we're telling ourselves. And I would scoff at people that had the idea that, you know, there is this omnipotent God, that everything is done through that thing and for that thing and thought of by that thing and is perfect. And, you know, I just look at the suffering of people. I just think of the suffering of people that I have experienced in my life as I'm in front of a person that is in the top 1% of like wealth in the world as they spew those ideas, and I would have resentment. But what I've personally began to experience is that I don't feel that there is an omnipotent entity outside all entities that is choosing for how things unfold and that it is perfect in that thing's experience. I do think that every conscious creature capable of understanding the words that we are saying right now has a God within them that has the potential to make perfect meaning out of whatever happens to them in a way that will aid in their ability to utter the cosmic yes throughout their life, and that we have evolved to have a nervous system that will intrinsically reward us for acting in ways that emanate forth from us as the cosmic yes. And so I think that there are individual gods inside each of us that can make mm-hmm. meaning mm-hmm. and make whatever happens to us feel like it's perfect. And then I think it comes down to pragmatism for me, man. It's run the Sisyphus myth, run the myth that everything is perfect in your life, see which one helps you grapple with life more. And what I have found is that neither of them work very well. Both cause a degree of frustration, but that third myth, the one that I offered, is the one that I have found for me personally that helps me, you know, dance through the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune.
I love that. Yeah, you know, it's funny that you bring that up, because one of the other things that I always struggle with what nomenclature to wrap around these experiences, but came through. One of the things that really hit me hard is, you know, there is this natural struggle occurring. You know, it is a fucking task, man. You know, like I said, you can look at the barren planets that have clearly tried. They've tried to ride the flow of life and they just can't get off the ground. And we are essentially on this cosmic flower in the middle of nowhere. Think about that, man. We're on a cosmic flower in the middle of nowhere. And the reason I think that's so important is because it's not perfect. You know, there, whatever is occurring, if there is some sort of intelligence behind it, the intelligence itself is struggling. Mm-hmm. It's not victorious yet. Perhaps there is an ideal, superlative possibility that we could call a perfect God. And maybe, this is so weird to say, but maybe God is in the hatchling phase right now. Maybe we innately feel that, you know, the Platonic ideal version of ourselves, the Platonic ideal version of superlative consciousness. But what if the reason we feel that is because it's our job to give birth to it? You know, maybe it exists in a potential form, and we're sort of seeing the seed of the fractal. You know, like if you look at a Mandelbrot fractal, it's like it has the potential to be infinite, but it needs to go through that unfolding or that zooming or whatever angle you want to look at it from. And it feels in some ways like perhaps it's very relative. Perhaps in our dimension, this is an unfolding process. Perhaps in another dimension, it's already completely realized. But it feels to me like there is this struggle that we're involved in collectively. And of course, it has to unfold individually. And that's, you know, where my love of the hero myth comes in. But it can be subverted, man. It can be subverted into the wrong games. And like you said, people can get caught up in their, I don't remember the exact word you use, but you said people can get caught up in their own weird little games, essentially. And yeah. whatever game you're playing is not inherently wrong. But if it's not contributing to the larger game of the cosmic yes, you have your priorities very fucked up.
I completely agree. And there's a couple of things that you said in there that I want to elaborate on. The first one is the idea that God is in its hatchling stage and it is us and we have this sense of what it could be. I think that that actually fits pretty nicely with my understanding of evolution and evolutionary biology and psychology. And it's that whatever the feeling of the omnipotent God is, I think that is our sense of the fundamental energy that's moving through all organic life in the universe that's seeking to basically not evaporate into the vacuum of nothingness. And I do think that the struggle is really like an eternal dance between void and life. And we are in, you know, we might, here's an interesting, this is an experience that I had on Huachuma when I was in Peru, but I just remember being on this plant, feeling, you know, the open heartedness of this plant course through me as my mind was running the scientific worldview that, you know, we're just on this ball in the middle of nowhere. And then there's this juxtaposition between the program that I know my conscious mind can run, that is the scientifically informed perspective of where we are, which culminates in this sense of like random chance in the middle of nowhere feeling in the, you know, in just the void of space. But then psychologically, I think we cannot help but experience the universe as if this is the center. This is not nowhere. This is literally the center where it's all emanating from. And so that's just an interesting juxtaposition that I think a lot, anyone who is scientifically minded, who grew up in the West, who has started to dance with the ideas that we are talking about, they have this almost schizophrenic, dualistic perspective where there's the scientifically informed model of the universe. And then there's the phenomenological felt experience of the center of the most important thing that's happening anywhere in any time. And there was a thing that you brought up at the very end that I remember being interested in. But once I started talking about those two previous ones, now I can't recall it.
Oh, shit. Well, there's a couple different directions I want to go with this, but I don't want to do a, one of them sort of a 180 that occurred to me toward the very end of the experience last night. And I kind of want to save that for later.
Yeah.
But I just think people's, so actually before we go off of this topic, I also had an insight on the whole random chance type of thinking.
Yeah.
Where is the randomness if everything is trying? You know, all the way down to that single-celled organism I was talking about that is trying to survive, right? It's not if everything is trying, where is the randomness in that? It's like, it's a, more of a collective expression of the will of nature.
Yeah.
Than it is random. You know, I guess you could argue that the placement of everything is random.
Right.
But even that,
I think where the randomness comes into is the idiosyncratic base fundamental physical laws that had to have come into existence at the very beginning of the Big Bang seemed okay. My understanding of this is not great, but I'm pretty sure the way I'm about to explain it is accurate based off of the science documentary that I saw. But essentially, there was a way that the Big Bang happened that was slightly idiosyncratic that allowed for laws of nature to unfold in a way where organic life could exist eventually. And that if the laws were any different, like 2 degrees of measurableness that we can't even comprehend, there wouldn't even be the chance for atoms to come together in a way for organic life to come into existence, for the force of nature to come out through. And so I think what I mean by the, or what I think most scientifically minded people who subscribe to the randomness That's kind of the fundamental area. But then you introduce the idea of there might be a multiverse, and there's billions of universes that are going through this birth stage, where if the fundamental laws of that universe aren't perfectly idiosyncratic to allow for atoms to come together in a way for conscious beings to eventually exist billions of years after the fact, that we would not be in those universes, obviously, and that we are in this one, and that that on some level is the randomness. And then you can bring it, you know, down to like the way the Earth collided with a different rock that allowed the moon to exist. That is why we have an atmosphere and able to have organic life on this planet.
Yes. Or you can go the Rupert Sheldrake angle and, you know, essentially what he said about what you just described is, give us one free miracle and we'll explain the rest.
I fucking love that quote. I actually just shared it with somebody yesterday.
Quote. And what he means by that is, if you talk to or you listen to any cosmologist talk about the quote unquote smoothness of the early universe, they have no explanation for it. Because like you said, everything was the exact right temperature, the exact right velocity, the exact right, you know, all of these things, where if it were just infinitesimally slightly different, nothing would, like, the universe would have been a soup of uninhabitable chemical nonsense, right?
Right.
And so, like you said, so the alternate way to explain that is, well, really, there's probably endless multiverses, and we just happen to live in the one that popped out a bud, you know? And I don't know, man. I mean, it's like we're trading in miracles at that point. You know, it's like,
I love that idea. Fucking, yeah, we're just trading
fucking multiverse. And it's like, I don't know, man. I think it's a crazy, I think it's a crazy ontological backflip on the part of materialists to explain the unbelievably fortuitous circumstances we live within. Or you could just say, yes, there is some unseen order that wants life to pop into existence. And, you know, I just, to me, that feels like a way more likely reality than there just being trillions and billions and quintillions of other universes that all failed. You know, I just don't.
For sure.
It's kind of pick your miracle at that point.
I love the idea of, we're just trading miracles. I think that that is something that could, you know, for sure be a great blog post that, you know, if you were the wrong type of person, you would try to force into a book, and then it would be one of those books that people feel like, man, that could have been a really good blog post. Anyways, the thing that popped up in me is that when I think about these type of ideas, I spent a lot of energy in my 20s trying to sort out what essentially were existentially unprovable or unfalsifiable myths about reality that just, it ate up a tremendous amount of my life force. And then when I found pragmatism as a metaphysical stance, I just feel like it's rapidly transformed my life in a way that, I really think it saved my conscious mind from being admitted into a mental institution when I was younger. Because we can't know these stories that we're exploring, but they're fun to explore it, especially if you have the mind to do it and the mouth to describe it. Because on some really fundamental evolutionary level, it's a display of fitness and it's attractive, period. But the fact of the matter is that we are on a planet. There are billions of people here, and lots of people are suffering more than they need to. And that we have a game that is unfolding on this planet, that you have a biology that wants certain things. You have a culture that wants certain things from the biological units in the culture. And there is a way to live this life that will maximize the amount of positive feeling that you experience, and that you can do it in a way that rewards you through attention and love and money, that you can then alchemize to help the greatest number of people suffer less. And so for me, pragmatism is the metaphysical belief. It is the bumper rails that I put onto my consciousness to try to keep the bowling ball going down towards, you know, what my goals are. And it's essentially, does this idea, if acted out, help me help other people in a way that allows me to live the life that I want to live? And if the idea doesn't contribute to that, you know, if it's a really cool idea, maybe I'll talk about it on a podcast or I'll smoke some weed and explore it alone. But I try not to allow the finite amount of energy that's going to course through my body in my lifetime spend too much time on those ideas. And it keeps me sane.
Yeah, it's got to funnel down. Yes, yes, it's got to funnel down into actionable stuff. Otherwise, you're just, you know, you're just engaging in these. And did you and I talk about this on the last episode of Third Eye Drops we did, where it's just the human mind has all of these unbelievable capacities that so far outweigh what we can physically do? Like, no. I think I said, it was either to you or to somebody else where I said, like, the eyes of the mind far outweigh the, what's the phrase? The eyes bigger than the stomach. The eyes of the mind are far bigger than the stomach of the body. You know, it's just, we can go these deep, deep existential thought experiments and ask these massive, massive questions that we lack the instruments to even begin to explore, you know? And so I absolutely agree with you. You have to be able to funnel this cosmic bullshit down into actionable things. Or what are you doing? You're spinning your wheels. You're jerking it. You know, you're just philosophically spreading your cheeks or whatever. And that's not really doing anybody any good, except for it's fun. But that brings us back to the pyramid, man. That brings us back to
absolutely
stratifying your behaviors and conceptualizing what the proverbial eye at the top overseeing everything is. And I think where this stuff becomes applicable is in defining that eyeball. Because if you, for people that aren't listening, you know, visualize the pyramid on the back of the dollar bill, it's unfinished. The eye at the top represents the transcendent. And the reason it's unfinished is because it's a work in progress, right? But it's a work in progress that's overseen by a higher intelligence. And that's you. That's society. That's the planet. That's everything. And if you can conduct yourself in that way as a living engine of that energy, you know, as flawed and limited as we are, you know, and that's, I mean, not to totally do a weird sidebar here, but that's the secret of Freemasonry. That's the initiation that you go through when you reach the third degree and you become a Master Mason, is you go through this resurrection myth where you play the part of someone who's died and resurrected using a secret name of God.
Yeah.
And that's then you leave the temple with the understanding of I've undergone the initiation of being reborn under a higher purpose. And everything you're supposed to do is supposed to be informed by that higher purpose. And that kind of a psychology has deep, deep application. Because if you start asking the right questions of like, what am I doing for a living? What is that contributing to? What, you know, and people don't ask themselves those questions, man. And it's, I think you need to have that big ethos informing your mundane actions.
Absolutely. Each of us has a highest value. And if you can't say yours, that means that you're probably under the tutelage of somebody else's without knowing it. And you're giving your life to some value that you actually don't resonate with. And I think it is one of the most potent things that we can do with our conscious mind, which is to set an intention for our being before the universe, that this is the thing that we are aiming ourselves at. And I've seen it over and over and over again, the power of knowing what it is you are trying to do and then how that affects how the universe responds to you. I don't understand how. And when it comes to pragmatism, I don't need to understand metaphysically how that works, but what I do see is that it works, and that the more clear you can be with yourself and the universe about what it is you are trying to do, the universe bows, if it's in your truth, like this is an interesting thing. I think that whatever our highest value is less chosen and more uncovered. And that there's this primal essence in us that is trying to help our conscious mind already see what it is that we are here and meant to do. And I know that on some level that can start to get woo-woo-y pretty quickly, but all of us have a relationship with our psyche, and that can come through the way our body feels, the slips that we have in everyday conversations where we mean to say one thing, but we say something else, our dreams, our fantasies, our daydreams. There's a thing inside of us that isn't our conscious mind that's trying to talk to us. And I think the more tools that you use to bow before that thing inside of you, the more quickly you will realize what it is that you are actually meant and intended to do. I like the idea that you are a question that the universe is asking. And if you can really hone in on what your question is, then you start to get the life that feels like the wind is at your back. You're at the top of the crest of the wave. You're seeing the sunset shimmering through the wave, as opposed to smashing your face against a wall over and over and over again. And one of the hardest things, man, is people who have very strong minds, who on a really fundamental level have high IQs, who have built amazing ego architectures about what they want to do. It's really scary to start paying attention to what that thing inside of you is asking you to be if it's not in alignment with the huge plan for your life that you've made
right
in your ego as a conscious mind.
Oh God, I'm having so many micro epiphanies right now, but before I go on to that, let me write this down before I forget it. But so that some of that reminded me of a Campbell quote that I believe he says in the Moyers interviews, which is, your life evokes your character and you find out more about it as you go on. You know, you were talking about it is sort of, it's not quite an attractor, like a cosmic attractor or whatever it is that Terrence McKenna talks about, where it's something pulling you toward it rather than the other way around. You know, we typically like to think of ourselves as we're the ones driving the meat suit and we're deciding where it goes. But, you know, you can invert that and almost think of it as like there are these archetypes pulling you forward, pulling your energy in a certain direction, kind of testing you and seeing if this is your direction or not. But I think that when you start to look at your life in that way, interesting things happen. And another thing you could say other than, your life evokes your character and you find out more about it as you go on, is you could say you find out more about what your question is in the nomenclature that you put it. And maybe, you know, if you don't know, if you genuinely are at a loss, I think just the biggest, most cliche existential whys are a great place to start. Because even though that might sound like really open-ended and adolescent and childish to just ask a question like, what's the meaning of my life? That question is going to get less obtuse over time. I think that there's tremendous value in just considering those really big open-ended whys when you're at a loss, because eventually they'll sharpen down into better, more actionable whys. And you can just start with the big ones and it's going to eventually funnel down into more actionable stuff if you're thinking about it in the right way. If you're again, like we were talking about before, underneath the right ethos and the right mindset, I think that those whys can be extremely powerful exploration tools for sure.
And the first thing that comes up in me when I hear people say like they truly don't know it's counterintuitive, but I think that the response to that is do less. Stop distracting yourself with all the things that you are doing habitually and just be still. Like, have a day where the intention on the calendar is to do nothing. And that doesn't mean watch Netflix. That doesn't mean go hang out with people. That doesn't mean get on your phone. It means do what we have done for hundreds of thousands of years before the last couple hundreds of years. And there was a tremendous amount of time where you did nothing. And I think that we all have this inner voice in us that's trying to help us, but most of us are so perpetually distracting ourselves that we say that we don't know. But truly, man, I think if you could get quiet with one person and you sat with them in front of them and you let them tell you that they don't know why they're here, and you just sit there in compassion and look them in the eye and try to encourage them not to try to justify anything and just sit there, I think they're going to start crying. And I think in a couple of minutes, they'll actually start to say exactly the things that they've needed to say for a long time. And then they're going to know. Like, that's the feeling that I get when I look people in the eye who say that they don't know what they're doing or they don't know what they're supposed to be doing, is there's this kind of like this frantic fear behind them, because they know that that's not actually the truth.
Yeah, they're stuck at the top of the circle of the monomyth, petrified to go underneath the dark line. You know, they're petrified to look underneath that line where it gets dark. It's here's the status quo. I've worked very hard to get to this point where everything is known and comfortable, and they get crippled by that comfort and they get so scared of even daring to go out there and explore that they just don't even want to leave the, you know, the proverbial house or the proverbial comfort of the top of the monomyth circle. And that this is another thing that I felt so deeply last night, how perfect the monomyth circle fits over the psychedelic experience at large, man. Yeah. Because there it's so, I mean, it's like, you know, the very first thing is the refusal to the call, where you're looking at the dose and you're thinking like, oh, fuck, do I really want to do this? Do I really want to take this? And then, you know, all of the anxiety you have after you take it, that if you're at all intelligent, you should have every time you do it. And then there's the, like, you know, that where it starts to come on and things, you know, you start to get hit with these big thoughts and you start to, you know, I mean, last night, it, for me, it really started with that kind of existential fear and loneliness and just, oh, we are on this rock, kind of cold and shivering. And, you know, my first thought, the very first thing I wrote down that brought me to blubbering tears was, what a special thing it is to be together.
Yeah.
And I meant that in like the deepest way. You know, I meant that like in friends, in relationships, in society, because can you fucking imagine being alone out there? Like really, truly alone on this rock, man. That would be, oh God, that would just be the most horrific, most terrible, terrible existence, just living in complete and utter isolation. And then from there, it's like the adventure opens up. We are together. We are doing stuff. We are progressing. We are trying. We are loving each other. We are creating. We are doing all these things.
We are.
And that means something, man. And it's, and not to get back into the giant existential context, but I don't think that that's for nothing. I think it's for the cosmic yes to continue. I think it's for consciousness to spread. I think it's for consciousness to get more informationally dense. I think it's for love to spread. I think it's for everything, dude. Another thing that brought me to tears, and like, I've never, ever, ever been the most gung-ho, we need to go out and explore outer space type of guy. But when I literally started to conjure a picture of inoculating Mars with life, it was like making me just just cry, man, you know, because like we said, life has been trying. Like, we can see that life has been trying on that planet. There's water, there are little things crawling around. We could be the aliens that we fantasize about coming to Earth to exactly. them.
Yeah, exactly.
Think about that, man. Like, we could bring society to another planet, and we could, I mean, it's just, I don't know if people out there feel this like I feel it at this moment, but that feels so significant and spiritual to me before or now, whereas before it kind of just felt like this feat of engineering, like, oh, look what we can do. But that's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is literally spreading consciousness and life to new planets, and, you know, going from being a single flower out in the middle of a dark nowhere to a rainforest out in the middle of nowhere.
Absolutely. And the image that I see when you describe that is there's this game that I played growing up called Final Fantasy VIII, and there's a scene in the beginning where they're invading a town and they have a map of the town, and then they put this transparent, almost like those not the scantron, but the overhead projector screens that you could write on that the light comes mm-hmm. through. He slapped that on top of the map, and it showed like how they would move throughout the actual map. And the reason I'm bringing that up is there is the scientific way of looking at the world, which is one type of map. But we are simultaneously in mythology right now. And there's a mythological map that you can put on top of everything that we're doing. And when you step out of the scientific framework and you step into the mythological framework, that is literally a God act. That is an act of God. We are the gods on some level doing something. We could do something for another planet that is akin to mythological godliness, like creating life. And like, you know, this is,
yeah.
A part of how my mind works is I have to be able to overlay the mythological map on anything that I'm interested in. And I went a couple of weekends ago, I went to a developer meetup at the local library, and I just listened to these people who were computer programmers just talk about what they were doing. And I was on a substantial amount of LSD, and
love it.
I started asking a lot of questions. And essentially, man, coders are literally Zeus's. They are using a keyboard to control gates on a computer chip that direct where electrons move. They're literally controlling lightning. Like, if we just took a step back and looked at our life through the mythological lens, like, we are in the myths right now. And when I see the world through that lens, it gives it so much fucking juiciness. And I think it's really helpful to be able to have both maps. Like, there is a scientific map, the engineering, but there's a mythical map for everything that we are doing right now in our culture on this planet. And both together, I think, make a really, really fun map that I think neither of the other maps without the other can achieve.
No doubt, man. I'm 100% the same way. I mean, humans in general are a beast of stories, but my story dial is cranked. You know, it's just, if there's not a good reason and a good why behind anything I'm doing, I can't do it. You know, but if you say that I'm a micro lightning engineer in the spirit of Zeus, it's way better. I could get down with that for sure. And I think, yeah, you're absolutely right. We need both the empirical intelligence and the mythological intelligence, the rational intelligence, the philosophical intelligence combined. And that's definitely what makes human beings. I mean, it's not the only thing that makes human beings special, but that's one of the very, very special things that humans can do. And, you know, I've never been really analytically minded. I never excelled at math, but math is a way to tell stories. Math is a way to take a series of symbols and test them logically. And then you see if the story works. You can eventually get to, you know, you can see if it mathematically works. I was just actually watching a video on string theory where they were talking about this, where they were saying they were using these exact terms that we're trying this story. We're trying this story about elementary particles to see if they work as strings, and mathematically it works. And we don't know if it works practically, but it's a story that we're trying to explain the universe. And that's what we're doing, man. We're creating stories and hierarchies all the way up and all the way down and trying them. And it's wild, man. It's wild that we've accomplished so much essentially just with a bunch of crazy nested Russian doll hierarchical stories. Like, that's, we've done everything around you that you can see with stories.
Absolutely. And it's the reason why I'm obsessed with stories. I think it's kind of, it's the fundamental tool that Homo sapiens have been using, you know, for 100,000 years to create culture. And it is how we think. And I think it is, it's the most pragmatic way to try to approach the world is through stories, just trying to filter everything that we do through stories. The most effective way that we learn is through stories. The most effective way that we remember things is if it's told inside of a story. And I think it's also like, it's the way our dreams talk to us, which I think is a whole different point. Mm-hmm. But I think we each have a God thing inside of us that is millions of years old, that is a culmination of our meat suits and the DNA inside of them trying to grapple with existence on this planet for millions of years. And that intelligence is inside of you, and it dreams for you. It dreams for your life. And I think that might be the dopest story that I've ever encountered.
Yeah, that's the true guru. Is the Jungian term the Senex, the kind of wise man archetype?
Yeah, that represents self. Yeah, if you're a man, it will come to you as a wise old man. And if you're a woman, it will come to you as a wise old woman.
Right, right. Do you think that's what that is? Or do you think this is even beyond, like, this is almost like, if that's the sort of manifested guru being, or is the God like the logos that is flowing into the guru being?
The way that I like to think about it is your psyche is the window of a cathedral. And the thing that we're trying to talk about is actual the sunlight, and the images that you see on the floor that is a refraction of the window are the images that you see in your dream. So they're fractaled. They are a refraction of a thing that we can't look directly at.
That makes sense, man. That makes sense. I think to look directly at it would be to almost annihilate the self. And I got to ask, dude, have you watched OA season 2 yet?
Man, you are not the first person to demand that I watch that in the last week. I have not.
There's some symbolism in there that's going to freak you the fuck out, because essentially exactly what you're talking about comes into play.
Fuck.
Without spoiling, I really can't say more without spoiling it. So I'll leave it at that. But
a beautiful thing.
There is some.
Go on. Sorry.
No. I was going to say there's some very juicy, very psychedelic, very Jungian overtones to that entire show. And the great thing is there's been several shows lately that you and I have talked about that seem to be pulling heavily from these archetypes, which is just, I just love it so much.
So speaking about, you know, putting your intention out into the universe, and what's really cool about it is it's a way to leverage social media to attract to you like the perfect things. Somebody recommended a book to me that I just devoured in 4 days. It's fiction, and I haven't read fiction in a long time. And it was called The Kin of Atta Are Waiting for You. Mm-hmm. And I just finished it right before this podcast. And I wept. And it's a story about a tribe of people who essentially live their entire lives in a way to try to amplify their connection to their dreams. And it is so good. So anyone listening who is interested in dreams who likes fiction or who thinks they don't like fiction like I am, I would highly recommend this book, and I'd recommend it to you too, man.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. So what is their, I guess it's hard to probably talk about without spoiling it, but is there a lot of, I would assume there's got to be a lot of young juice sprayed on there, since he's just absolutely so entrenched with dream thoughts,
absolutely,
and dream contextualization.
It's actually on the back of the book. It specifically says that the author was inspired by Jungian psychology.
Amazing. Yeah, that sounds
so incredible. The whole thing was, yeah, so good. Yeah. And I fucking devoured it. But yeah, what's up?
So I know you're obviously massively into Jung, but have you drawn any conclusions on the dreaming thing? Do you kind of subscribe to the notion that, you know, the collective unconscious is feeding you archetypical symbols through your dreams, and then it's your job to sort of learn how to decode those as a, you know, with a long-term goal of kind of integrating the self and individuating?
If I have a religion, that's my religion. I've had an experience recently that has caused me to start writing that I'm not going to get into here, but it is basically, the gist of it is, I set the intention out into the universe that I wanted to kind of uncover my bullshit around love. And I had a couple of dreams that were deep, big dreams that essentially began to point me towards the Samson myth from the Bible. And I'd never read it before. And I went and I read it. And the ending of that myth, which I had never encountered in my entire life, helped me see that I was inside of a Samson complex as it relates to how I thought about women romantically and what my unconscious patterns were around when I felt betrayed or rejected, to a level of accuracy that feels borderline schizophrenic. And so I knew that I needed to start to write about this to really organize my own mind. And I'm still grappling with it. I actually just finished like the first rough draft of like a seed form of whatever this is going to be. And I would like to send it to you. So that's an official invitation. But
yeah, please.
It seems like I would have to be lying to myself if I didn't emphatically say yes to what you just asked about how do I feel about dreams. And I think there are different types of dreams, but that the more you begin to pay attention to your dreams and try to kneel before them in a way where you're trying to learn, that your dreams can teach you things that you don't know, which is such an eerie thing to really sit with, that there is some part of you that first has the ability to create worlds and does it effortlessly every night. Mm-hmm. And that the worlds that that thing creates can possibly teach you things that you don't know. So there is some part of you that knows things that you don't know that you know, that teaches you through creating fucking worlds for you.
Yeah. 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 And even if we're going to take the totally skeptical view, like there's got to be at least a few people out there listening, probably not many considering, you know, the makeup of the audience and the interests of the audience, but there's got to be people out there who think, nah, dreams are just like mind junk. It's part of, you know, it's part of the sort of neuronal cleaning process that occurs on a nightly basis. And it just, you know, forms nonsense in your brain. Even if you're all the way on that end of the spectrum, let's bring it back down to utility, like we were talking about before. Let's bring it back down to something pragmatic. Every single thought is a seedling of a potential world, man. You could, even if you're diving into something that didn't mean anything and you start journaling about it and start writing about it, you're going to come across a gold nugget in that process. Because, I mean, I've been writing way more lately, as you know, and it is just an unparalleled way to organize your thoughts. I am so much sharper with my, you know, because being in an open-ended podcast allows you to get away with a lot. You can sort of just stop talking, go off in another direction, bring something up, and then back off from it. You can't do that in writing. You have to see ideas through, and you have to make sure they make sense, and you're providing the right flow and the right amount of context and the right amount of references if you're going to go down that way of writing.
Style.
So,
yeah.
It's just, it's so important. And I think the more, like, people just don't write enough. 100%. They don't write enough. And when you don't write enough, that means your thoughts are in sort of an unorganized clump. So whether you're going to even, you know, publish it is one thing, but definitely, and I know you're on board with this, definitely at least journal some shit. And that way you can at least untangle the cords, because the cords are definitely tangled if you're not doing anything to untangle them.
Absolutely. And I think that that gets to the fundamental point about dreams, is that if you are a skeptic, try the experiment of writing down your dreams and then asking yourself, what could this be trying to tell me? And the way that our mind works is that if you start writing and you're genuinely open to thinking about what these things could be trying to tell you, there is an innate intelligence in you already that we've just learned to distract ourselves from. That if you take the time to ask that question and write about it, your dreams are going to help your conscious mind come to big conclusions that if you try to use them to change the way you behave, I believe you would start to live a life more in coherence with the person you want to be. And by the definitions of pragmatism, it's true.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. So I'm going to take, I know this is your podcast and you have a way you like to do things, but I have a left turn I want to bring up.
Do it.
So earlier when we were talking about the cosmic yes, and I said I had another direction that I didn't even want to go yet, that came up toward the end of my experience last night, was what would a cosmic no look like? And I don't mean a nihilistic no, but I mean a rejection of the sort of material world, sort of a rejection of what we're, you know, the notion what we're striving for is not here. It's not in the physical, temporal, it's not in this space. Mm-hmm. And the trick may actually be to say the cosmic no. You know, that's certainly the kind of traditional Buddhist direction. Even I would even argue maybe the Christian mindset, because there is this underlying notion that the here and now is very temporary and it's here for a reason, but ultimately it's not the ultimate reality. So maybe we shouldn't be obsessed with the cosmic yes, but we should just be obsessed with finding a measure of spiritual truth in this realm. And that's the kind of underlying point. And I can't dismiss that. You know, I feel I'm way more attracted to the cosmic yes and to trying and to adventure, because the cosmic yes is biting the apple, right? The cosmic yes is taking a bite of the apple in the Garden of Eden, knowing full well that everything's going to go fucking crazy after you take the bite. It's opening Pandora's box. But as humans, that's what we do. We do the thing we're not supposed to do, and then we deal with the consequences and let everything unfold. And that just seems like it's, you know, adventure is deep in the heart of the human. It's deep, deep, deep in the mind of the human. And I feel like we're built for it. I mean, look at how adaptable we are. We can eat anything. We can figure out how to go into goddamn outer space. We can do all of this stuff. So it seems like we probably should be doing it. We can create endless iterations of art. You know, you can, the capacity of human beings to do different things is just so unbelievable. And we've only scratched the surface. So it feels like we're supposed to go in that direction of the yes and the exploration. But what if the actual trick is to do a cosmic no? What do you think?
I can see how if you created a story like the ones that are offered in Buddhism or Christianity, where it's almost like saying no to this life,
so that you can get a yes to a life after this life. And the way to get that yes actually gets people to act in a way that is actually saying a cosmic yes. I can totally see that. But when you say cosmic no, I could not shake the image of what a cosmic no is. It's the Joker in Batman burning the money in front of the robbers or in front yeah. of the criminals.
I love that.
And that the true cosmic no, I think, or just what came to my mind as to what the cosmic no is it's life becoming so twisted where it becomes its highest goal to negate the cosmic yes. And I think that that is the eternal struggle inside each human being, is we have a part of us that is saying yes. And we also have a part of us that wants to say no. And it's this twisted, twisted part that I think, you know, it's kind of the hero's journey. It's one of the main obstacles that you will have to face in your dance, is to come to terms with the cosmic no thing inside of you, which is the Joker, which is, I'm here to negate as much life as possible and to maximize the amount of suffering for the life that isn't negated.
Hmm. Yeah, that's considerably more dark. I mean, yeah, that would certainly be a kind of that. Yeah, but I'm not even saying like a nihilistic no. I'm saying like almost like a metaphysical rejection of material. You know what I mean? It's because there is obviously an inherent problem with the spreading of material as well. You know, I love the idea of this utopian cosmic garden that I was talking about before, where knowledge and consciousness and warmth and love is being spread through a cold, inert wasteland of space. But at the same time, let's be real, there's probably going to be bumps. Well, there's definitely going to be bumps. There's going to be, you turn up the dial on life, you turn up the dial on suffering to an extent, you turn up the dial on consumerism, on waste, on, you know, all of these other things that we can't separate from material life. So maybe it's the rejection of that. That's the ultimate trick. You know, maybe it's the going into the monastery and going deep inside and finding some kind of truth that is the real. And that's what I meant by the no. But I think there it's so tricky, man, because even within Buddhism, there's different ideas. You know, the Tibetan Buddhists want loving kindness. They want a reformation of society where all of humanity is predicated off of, you know, giving and altruism and love. And then there's Theravada Buddhists who just want to go into monasteries by themselves and just meditate. And they don't, you know, they're not taking the Bodhisattva vow. They're just trying to exit samsara and never be incarnated again. So there's different ways to interpret all of this shit. It's crazy. It's crazy.
And what's beautiful is we get to pick. We can play with these mm-hmm. stories. And I think the fundamental thing that I think an initiation ritual teaches you is that the conception of reality that you have can be broken, but you are not destroyed when it is broken, and that there is a thing in you that is capable of creating a new world. And that's the Phoenix. That's where the initiation of the Freemasons were getting at, that you were talking mm-hmm. about. Mm-hmm. It's the core. It's one of the core pieces of the hero's journey of the monomyth, is the rebirth. And once you have that first rebirth, you have the potential to see like, oh, I am not any of the stories. I am the thing that creates and chooses stories. And then you just get to play with stories for the rest of your life. And I think at least the story that I've chosen is, what is the type of story that I can live and that I can share that reduces the non-essential suffering of the collective to the greatest degree before, you know, I pass into the abyss? Do that.
Yeah, that's a noble one. That's absolutely a noble one, man. Are you still, so do you still typically on this new pod ask questions, or do you leave it more open-ended?
So for people who I haven't done the base questions for, I ask them those questions. But because I've done your myth, I just let this one become what it could be. But I will absolutely, I feel like I'm scratching the surface of something that's going to be my life's work. And it has to do with these questions that I'm trying to use to get to people's stories. And I just want to hone these questions more and more deeply over hundreds and hundreds of podcasts. But so, if it's the guest's first time on, unless they're an expert in something that I want to explore for the audience, I'm going to always come back to these questions.
I think that's a really valuable thing, because the when you have even a, you know, a somewhat directed way to set the stage, it creates, you know, one of the things about doing a really open-ended podcast like mine is you have to, especially when you first meet people, like you're saying, there's the just human feeling out process of how much do I want to let my guard down? How comfortable am I sharing this story? How honest do I want to be about this? But you're kind of forcing people into a very deep psychological space, like from the outset, by asking those questions. So I think that that's a really valuable tool and a really great way to just slice to the center, because that's what we all want to hear. And I think that's why everybody listens to podcasts like this, is because they want to slice to the center. They're tired of the cursory skimming across the surface bullshit, and they're getting something much deeper than they're used to, than you can get anywhere else, because there's going to be a commercial interruption, or there's going to be oh, we're out of time, you know, go see this new movie, or there's just some vapid nonsense that they've been scrolling through all day. And this is an opportunity to actually push the limits, possibly think about thoughts you've never thought of before. And the quicker you can remove those obstacles, the better, for sure. And I think those questions do that for sure.
And I appreciate that. And what I'm witnessing in person, man, is, especially when I do these podcasts in person, after the episode is over, they're looking at me like they owe me something. Like that what just transpired on the podcast was a gift, in like the most intimate way that you can be with another person while still having clothes on. And
yeah. You should try without clothes. You could add that, no clothes.
I will get there one day. I'm going to speak that into the universe, that there will be an episode before episode 1000 that will be done without clothes on. Thank you for bringing that into existence.
How do you know you're not doing it right now?
Because we aren't in person.
But it truly, I'm like, the fucking heroes are the people who come on the podcast, man, and who share, like, I'm constantly blown away. Like, when you're in person with someone, you can see on them where what they are about to say is a thing they've never actually articulated before, and they're afraid. And on the podcast, it's happening over and over and over again. I see them feel that, and then they say it anyways. And like, those are.
Hey, fam. Yeah. So the audio did just cut out. I'm using an audio program that I'm no longer going to use. I just want to say, Michael, thank you for coming on, and I appreciate you dealing with the audio difficulties. And I just want to thank all of you for listening, and the people who have come on the podcast. You guys are some brave motherfuckers, and I love you. Hope you guys have a beautiful day. Namasteezy.